We want to thank the committee for Fun Fest for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. It's a privilege to be here. I've immensely enjoyed this weekend and the speakers and the fellowship and the little meetings we've had with each other and the discussion groups. Thank you for permitting me to an opportunity to continue to grow as a result of this weekend and the few days that I've been here with you. Distinct privilege. I asked Bryant before the meeting, I said, do you ever get over being anxious about doing something like this? And he says, it gets a little better. He says, it's really harder when you're talking close to home. it's harder to get over it. And I got the front row here filled with, in the second row, so with some of my usual running mates in the program in suburban Charlotte and in the Charlotte area. So it's a little anxiety, but I'll get over it. I'm reminded what Bill says in the 12 and 12 in the steps where he says that my purpose here is to improve my character and not my reputation. So, and did you notice how the program really works? Dr. Bob, in his letter to the first, first edition of the Big Book, made a statement in there about alcoholics. He said, you may rely absolutely on anything they have to say about themselves. That's a strong statement. He wouldn't sign his name, but he made that statement about alcoholics and how true it's been during this conference. Did you notice that Brian got up here on Friday night, those of you that were with him, and said that was the only time that he was going to get up here before meeting started and say anything? And you can rely absolutely on anything he had to say about himself then, because he's been up here in front of every meeting that we've been. I am a member of the Indian Trail group of Alcoholics Anonymous in suburban Charlotte. That's my home group. It's been my home group since we moved to Charlotte in 1986. When I was in Stone Mountain, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta, my home group was the Memorial Drive Beginners Group. I lived there 7 years. That was my home group all the time that I was there. As Bill told you, I came into the program in Greensboro. The Lawndale group in Greensboro was my home group all the time that I was in the program in Greensboro. I had two sponsors initially in the program in Greensboro. One of them was killed in an unfortunate automobile accident. I got another one to augment the one that remained. They were my sponsors until I moved to Atlanta. I had a sponsor in Atlanta, the only one I had there. Bill's the only one I've had for the last 10.5 years here. I tell you that only to tell you that I have been satisfied, or permitted myself, or the program has permitted me to be satisfied with these arrangements. Now, not all of them have always done everything that I thought they ought to do, and they've not done some things that I thought they ought to do. But because of the power of this program, I have been able to maintain my allegiance to both the home group concept and to the sponsor concept and relationship. And I heard that kind of early in the program, and I picked up on it, and I didn't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure out what that message was. And I'm glad of that. It's been good for me. Maybe it'll be good for you. October 17th, 1965, a Sunday, about this time in the forenoon, I was sitting in the corner of the living room in a house, wasn't a home, in a house, at 3705 Normandy Road in Greensboro. I was sitting there in my underwear, drinking out of a quart of something, I think White Horse Scotch, I don't know, or chasing it with Pall Mall cigarettes, social drinking. Not harming anyone. I had opened that bottle that morning sometime early when I'd given up trying to sleep. And I said that was a house. It wasn't a home, and it wasn't. Let me tell you some of the specifications that existed there. The family consisted of my wife, Barbara. We'd been married 10 years. Two daughters, ages 8 and 6. Vocationally, I was the claims manager for a New York State insurance company in the state of North Carolina, and that was still intact. I was bankrupt spiritually, totally bankrupt, had been for as long as I can remember. Emotionally in awful shape, physically in bad shape, as I usually was under those conditions. I drank in my underwear because I'd learned to do that. I had some, I know that I'm the only one here who has this problem, so I can speak to, I want to, you know, explain it to you because you won't understand. I had some personal hygiene problems when I drank, and I found that the least clothing I had on, the less difficulty I'd have with these hygiene problems. It seemed like I was never getting where I needed to be quite in time, and things like that. So there I was, social drinking, that Sunday morning, 17th of October, 1965. Now, I never at any point in my life up until that time ever sat down and said, I want to be in that condition, in that situation someday. Never did plan on that, but there I was. Nothing in the days and years that led up to that, except for my alcoholic personality and my use of alcohol to make me feel better, had anything to do with me being there. I was born and reared on a farm in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. For those of you that think that I'm 78, I was born on August 19th, 1930, which makes me 47. And I was born in a good family in the Depression years, but a good family. And I can't use my family, the roots, the standards, the customs that I learned about, the good things, the good people that I was introduced to as a youngster, were all in place and all there. And I didn't have any trouble as a youngster getting along. I really didn't. The family stayed intact. My mother and my father, a 7-year younger sister, and a conservative, thrifty, loving, community-supporting atmosphere. Great. Went to church, learned about God, heard a lot about Him. Didn't get to know Him very well, but heard a lot about Him. Those kind of things. And I went on through life with that kind of opportunity. But you know, something happened. About the time I was, get my watch off here because Barbara asked me just before, make sure I had it, and also asked me, told me to take the skull out of my mouth so that I did both of those things. She's got to go to the toilet. She won't miss this. She wants to make sure I'm telling the truth. I reached a point in my life when some things began to happen internally, I suppose. You know, maybe some vital body juices started to flow differently or different juices or something, you know, but you know, in my young teen years, that seemed to occur. We may call that adolescence or whatever. And but in my case, a very important thing that was to be a negative for me, some difficulty for me, was that I began to develop some ideas of my own about how things ought to go and what the standards ought to be and what my friends ought to look and act like. I didn't learn until you folks got a hold of me that was self-will. You see, I hadn't had any up until then. I'd been under the pretty tight control of this unit that I was in, and I didn't have any trouble. But once I started to get some fantastic and intelligent ideas about what was good for me in life out there, my life changed. And I read later on in the book, it's got a blue cover on, that says that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success because in that condition I'm almost always in conflict. And I began to be in conflict. And very quickly, you know, it was evident. I got thrown out of a little one-room schoolhouse. First person ever knew that got thrown out of there. Couldn't finish with my classmates in the sixth grade. Had to go to the high school ahead of those folks. Couldn't finish that high school. Got thrown out of there because I couldn't get along with people because I was operating on my own newfound standards and ideas. And I was, and if you want to know how I felt, I can tell you that Dr. Silkworth sums it up in three words very well. Restless, irritable, discontent. And I went through my teen life feeling restless, irritable, and discontented. And just like you, if you're alcoholic, and just like you're alcoholic, if you're not, one day, somebody that I was hanging around with had something to drink, and I drank it, and I found a solution. The book says a sense of ease and comfort. Folks, I can tell you that I experienced a sense of ease and comfort. That the cow manure, the chicken manure, the dust, the sweat, the hard work that my dad thought was necessary for character building didn't bother me a bit. I could mix with the people that I was with better. I felt more comfortable. I was funnier. I felt more relaxed. I could dream about how good it was going to be tomorrow when I got out of this setting that I was in here where I was having these little scrapes with authority. And alcohol permitted that in me. Nothing had. And I felt better. And I filed that away. Now, I didn't instantaneously become a round-the-clock 24-hour drinker, but I can tell you from that very moment, as I look back, once I took a drink, I could not predict what was going to happen from that very moment. Went on through life. I got a little piece of an education in college. I had to enlist in the service in January 1951 because I was trying to beat the draft during the Korean War, and I enlisted in the Air Force, and all those things that typically happen to us happened to me. I continued to drink heavily. I continued to use it as a means of living and coping, and probably the thing, as many people say from up here, that saved my life for many years was that sense of ease and comfort that I continued to experience. I got married, and we had children, and things that never happened to other people. My military career wasn't very short. In fact, it was kind of long. And just to kind of sum this thing up and get on into what I like to talk about, I find some things once in a while that help show what kind of happened to me as a result of my alcoholism. Bill talks about the thing, two trains passing in the night, you know, kind of happened. Quick, and if you aren't watching, you know, it's done before the high-speed train. A friend of mine in Greensboro talks about the roller coaster. He says it takes you, you know, if you know what a roller coaster does, it takes you a long time to get to that first peak, doesn't it? Clickety-click, clickety-click, you're going up that thing. And once you get up the top of that first one, at the bottom. That kind of happened to me. The Air Force has what they call an officer's effectiveness report, an OER. And I picked up some excerpts out of it. Now, an OER has several columns in it. It's, if you looked at it this way, over on the left side was just barely hanging in there, you know, and over on the right side was just close to being godly. And there were different categories in there. In the sections, they'd have three breakdowns so they could give them a lot of options. And mine looked something like this. In October of 1954, co-pilot on a KC-97 combat crew, my aircraft commander said he rated me in the dependable in the middle of a dependable, typically effective officer. He said this about me: interested in his specialty flying, but at times disinterested attitude towards those details and responsibilities not concerned with flying. So it may be due to his inexperience and youthful outlook. With time, added responsibility, and supervision, he will probably overcome this weakness. May of 1955, different evaluator. Middle third of dependable, typically effective officer. January 1956, high third of dependable, typically effective officer. Demonstrates good air judgment at all times and obeys all the rules of safety. Enjoys flying. A credit to any crew. September of 56, middle third, a very fine officer. Oops, I jumped over into this next to the top category, middle third. Fine officer, asset to his unit and the Air Force, thoroughly trained in his duties and capable of assuming an aircraft commander's position without further training. June 1957. Now I'm an aircraft commander on a combat-ready crew. And I'm in again over in the middle third, a very fine officer of great value to the Air to the service. Outstanding young officer. I was augmented into the regular Air Force from the reserve, and in November of 58, I'm on the upper third of this very fine officer of great value to the service. Again in October of 59, upper third. April of 1960, outstanding, right-hand category, only one column over there, can't go any further. The colonel, who was a bird colonel, who was the commander, said of me, outstanding, one of the very few outstanding officers I know, among the top three of the 22 captains assigned to my command. February 1961. Back into dependable, typically effective officer middle report. There'd been an incident. In which they referred to in the report. There'd been an incident involving enlisted man and I and the air police, in which both of the enlisted man and I were intoxicated. That was in February 1961. In November of 1961, only 8-10 months later. See, I'm already back down in the middle. By 9 months later, by the end of 1961, in November, a board of officers consisting of two major generals, a brigadier general, had been convened to determine whether or not I ought to remain on active duty in the United States Air Force. And as a result, I was dismissed under the provisions of an Air Force Regulation 36-2. Left the Air Force on Christmas Eve 1961 with a general discharge. Here are some of the things they said in their report. Has conducted himself in a manner incompatible with exemplary standards. Standards of personal conduct, character, and integrity, including the excessive use of alcohol as follows. Cola. Big list. Several documented incidents that occurred. Went further and said, during the period from April of 1961 to October 1961, has repeatedly incapacitated himself for the proper performance of his duties by overindulgence in alcoholic beverages to the extent that he has had to be hospitalized on several occasions, has received two Article 15. Reason, alcoholism, chronic and severe. In those files, there was a little white envelope with red typed on it. Sensitive medical data. This was interesting reading. But they'd asked me what I thought the problem was, and here's what I told them. A typical alcoholic response. Things hadn't been going as well as I wanted them to. Now, for those of you that have to sit down and think about whether you're alcoholic or not, or whether you want to have to think about whether your life is unmanageable and you have trouble making a decision about coming into the program or pursuing a program of recovery, I feel sorry for you, because, you see, I have this information in writing, and I had it a long time before the date I referred to, you see. All I got to be able to do is read. You don't have to be very good at that, to pick up on this. I did what all good 31-year-old married men with two little children ought to do at that point in my life. I moved back in with my mother. My father had recently died, and so I moved back in, and I tried to put my life together. And for the next 3.5 years, the first paragraph in the third chapter of the book, even with this written evidence that I had, refers to me when it talks about my unwillingness to admit that I was different. Countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people said would occur, and they did. The for the next 3.5 years with all this information and determination that I could muster up by myself. I tried to get things back together, and you know that I wasn't very successful at that. Old, I wouldn't drink for a while, and I would fall up the ladder of success and ended up where I did. The week leading up to that Sunday, I had taken a drink on, I suppose, Monday or Tuesday, I'm not sure. I stopped by a place in Greensboro called The Mug. It was in the Lawndale Shopping Center. For those of you from Greensboro, no longer there. There's another place there now that isn't quite as macho, I don't think, as the Mug was. But I stopped in there to have one of those innocent beers that I would have, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Needed to feel better. Might have had a bad day. Well, I might have had a routine day. Well, it might have been a good day. I don't know. I needed to feel better with an innocent bottle of beer. And the following Sunday that I referred to, I hadn't been back to work. I hadn't eaten. I hadn't shaved. I hadn't bathed except when necessary. Sometimes this hygiene problem would catch up with me, and that would be absolutely essential, and I would do that. But you see, there I was. One of the things I didn't mention early on was that the two girls, ages 8 and 6, were not there. Barbara, who's in the back now, wisely, as she would when I was in that condition or in one of those situations, had taken them next door to a neighbor's house where they'd been a couple of days, because I really, in her opinion, and obviously was unfit to be around. And they were next door. But there I was. I'd been there many times before. I knew what was ahead for me. I knew I had to come off this stuff. I knew that there were a lot of things at stake, and I knew what was going to happen. You know, I knew I was scared to death, folks. I know you don't identify with that, but I knew what I was going to have to do. And that's frightening for me. That's frightening for me, because I know about the sleepless nights, and I know about the not eating, and I know about the fits and the things that whistle through my mind and those things. But a day like many days, but something happened that forenoon, probably about this time of the forenoon, I don't know, but as I sat there social drinking under those conditions with those set of specifications going on, I got a glimpse very quickly what had happened, what was happening, and what was going to happen. But more important, I understood just briefly what the problem was, what it was. And it was me. And it was that stuff that I was drinking to make me feel better. And it wasn't her, and it wasn't them, and it wasn't the narrow-minded military, and it wasn't all of these other things that impact a guy who's in a routine life like I am. And I put it up. I gave her the bottle. She doesn't know what she did with it. And after, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to call. Now, we had become affiliated with a church on paper. Maybe you know about that. That means probably did that because of the children. You know, they would need it. I didn't know what to do, but I thought maybe I could call that minister. And so when he had time to get back from the church service to the parsonage, I called him. And I told him briefly what was wrong and that I needed to see him if he could come. And he came immediately. And I told him, first person that I'd ever told honestly what was going on, honestly about myself. And he looked at me with all the compassion and love and understanding that a man of his profession can. And he says, I can't help you. But he says, I know some people that can. Will you let me call them? I said, call them. For those of you that are hung up on preachers, or those of you that are hung up on third-party 12-step calls, hear me out. Because he called a member of the church. His name was Boyd Christopher. And Boyd had a running mate whose name was Wade Johnson. And the two of them came just as quickly as Marion Workman had, and all of us sat in the living room of that house. Now, to relieve any concern, I had cleaned up. I got cleaned up a little bit, and these two men came. And I didn't have any idea what was going to happen. There was an article in the December 1987 Grapevine that I read and caught my eye, and I liked it. I love it so much because it talks about me. It talks about that day. It talks about some of the things that happened to me in 1961. 1961 was one of my better years. And I had been in some places that Jack was talking about last night, you know, that where they put you. And I always ended up in those places. When you're in one of those places like Jack and I were in, you never sat in there and mistaken it for being in charter by the whatever. You didn't think, I wonder where the meditation trail is. The article in the Grapevine was entitled "A Man with a Big Red Parrot on His Shirt," and he goes on. He tells about his failed attempts at AA in that article, and he was in one of these places on an involuntary commitment. I know what that means. That means he didn't go in there on it by his choice, his own choice. He didn't sit around one day and say, "I think I'll go into this padded room in this locked ward of the county hospital." And there's another very important thing. He won't get out that way either. You know, he won't sit there one day, "I think I'm ready to leave," and go. So there he was, and he said that he wanted somebody to talk to, so he rattled his door to his room, and a husky orderly, and I know about husky orderlies. Let me tell you that when they get hired, part of their questions they ask them, they don't ask them these questions: "How compassionate are you?" When they use the term husky orderly, that's exactly what he was. And a nurse came, and he asked him to please call someone to come and talk to him, and the nurse assured him that no one would visit him in this place, certainly not a complete stranger. And the door slammed and locked, and he went back, and he started to think, and he thought back on Bill's statement that he'd read, that each of us must conform reasonably well with steps and traditions of this program, or else we shall go mad or die. And he realized that he was living that prediction out right then. And he was overcome with that last thing, that total despair and abandonment that we feel in those conditions. And there was a knock on the door. And the man with a big red parrot on his shirt came through the door. And he said as he approached him, he was relaxed, smiling, and confident. And he stepped past the nurse toward him, and as he made this statement, "As he shook my hand, the miracle that had been passed on from Bill Wilson to Dr. Bob continued its eternal journey." And he didn't have a drink since. When these two men came into the living room at 3705 Normandy Road that day and shook my hand, the miracle that had been passed on from Bill to Dr. Bob continued its eternal journey into my life and into our lives. These two men sat there and did exactly what the book says they should do. Didn't have a book with them. Didn't have a big book with them, but they did what the book said to do. They shared with me their experience and some of their strength and some of their hope. And they had drank and felt and behaved and thought just exactly like I had, drank like I had, and I hadn't been in touch with anybody like that before. So I thought I was the only one in this fix. One of them hadn't had a drink in 9 years and the other one in 5. And I was convinced that these guys knew what they were talking about. You see, I hear people around AA today, sometimes they've been around 5-6 months, and I say, "What step are you working on?" And they said, "I'm still working on step one." Well, I didn't have that problem, folks, because I worked on step one out there drinking whiskey. That's where I worked on step one, out there drinking whiskey. And I probably had already, as I look back in retrospect, had taken step one that forenoon. I'd admitted my powerlessness over alcohol and the unmanageability of my life. In retrospect, as I read the material, it says in the book that there's only two requirements for me to begin in the program or to pursue the program, and that is to want what you have, requirement number one, and be willing to go to any length to get it, requirement number two. And I think that I had requirement number one as these two men were sitting in that living room talking to me, sharing their experience. And I believe that I got requirement number two. I was willing to go to any length because I believed in what these men said. They brought hope in a hopeless, despairing situation. And I hadn't had any, and she hadn't had any. And anybody else involved in my life had had no hope for me for a long time. They said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? And I said, yes, and they called me back about every half hour wondering whether I'd changed my mind. I know you understand that. But at 7 o'clock or so, the horn blew out in the driveway, and they were there, and we came to Burlington. You see, Wade and Boyd and Bill Norman thought the same about that Sunday night Greensboro meeting, and they thought I needed to come to Burlington. And so they brought me to Burlington, and I was introduced to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sick. One of them refers to that as carrying the body. I wasn't well. You know what kind of condition I was in. But let me tell you, somebody that was in that room that night, there were probably 15 people, I don't know. One of the guys that was in that room that night was Jimmy, the guy that led the old-timer sing yesterday. Jimmy was there with his old running mate, Crumpler, who always pulled on his toes, you know, as he sat. Both of them sat right over on the left side right here. I can remember where they always sat, right there. I remember later on some of the people who were at that meeting, but I remember that the guy that talked was a guy by the name of Nat from Danville. And, you know, but I wasn't able to remember some of those things. But I picked up a chip. And after the meeting, everyone there came up and shook my hand and said that they were glad to see me and that they understood some of the things that were going on with me. Now, it hadn't a great deal of time passed since that Sunday morning, but already I had experienced a couple of things that I hadn't experienced ever as long as I could remember, hope and understanding. Two pretty big rewards right off the bat, just out of the gate. We went back to Greensboro that night, and Wade said a couple of things, said one thing to me that stuck, as I can recall. He said this: you never have to drink again if you don't want to. And I understood that. I wasn't very quick, and I wasn't very alert, and I was incapable probably of understanding that, but I understood it because I had been introduced to two people who had felt and acted the same way I had, who hadn't had a drink in 9 and 5 years respectively, who had a program of strength that pulled them out of this condition, the same condition I was in, and now I had gone to a place where they gathered to sharpen their tools and to learn about the programs that supported them on that journey. And I knew that he was right, that if I drank again, it was by choice. I hadn't had that in a long time. I made an error, that error in judgment, right off the bat. That night I asked Wade how many meetings I should go to. Ought not to have done that, but anyway, I did it, not thinking, you know. I said, how many meetings should I go to? And he said, Wade would point his finger at you, so sometimes he would touch me with it to make a point. And he said, 7 meetings a week would be enough for you. He didn't ask me about my social calendar. He knew I didn't have one. I hear a lot about soccer practice. He didn't ask me about soccer practice. I hear a lot about that. Didn't ask me about that. 7 a week. And so I began with these two men under their wing to be introduced to a program that was going to save my life because I never took a drink since that day. Here's what happened. They took me to O. Henry Group. They stayed with me most of the next day. They made me go to work, and they stayed with me most of the day. They come and pick me up in the middle of the morning for coffee, and at noon, and we went to lunch, and they ate. And we, middle of the afternoon, and at 5:30, we go to the old Franklin drugstore that was down on Lawndale Drive in the same shopping center with the mud, where a bunch of alcoholics would collect about 5:30, have some coffee, and at 7:30, the horn would blow. Took me to O. Henry Group on Monday night. Open Door Group on Tuesday, and Fisher Park on Wednesday, and Dogwood on Thursday, Lawndale on Friday, Pepsi on Saturday. Sunday night we get together in one of the homes, and they play a reel-to-reel tape, somebody's talking, and that was the pattern, and I began to get better, and I began to recover. You see, some of the things I heard early on, that first night I heard the Serenity Prayer when you said that, and I thought that makes a lot of sense to me. And I also heard your term God as I understand him, and I was not surprised at that. And in retrospect, again, I think not only had I taken step one out there drinking whiskey before I got there, certainly that morning, but by this time, by the time maybe at the end of that first day, because of what those two men and you people in that first group, Jimmy, had brought to me, that I had come to believe that a power greater than myself would have something to do with this deal. Because I was sure that these two men had not recovered by their own power. Because I'd been unsuccessful at that. I had power. But I've been unsuccessful. So I began to listen. And I heard some things early on that you didn't have to be an intellectual giant to figure out. Easy stuff. Change playgrounds and playmates. I understood that. Made sense. There were other things. I heard that they said, stick with the winners. I can pick up on that. I can pick up on that. Some of those things that were vital to me. Nobody carrying the book. Nobody running around with a 12 and 12 under arm. We're going through the book like I do today. I would say, go to page 65 in there. Last paragraph, third sentence. None of that. But they were talking about information that they had gathered out of the book. And they led me on into the point where I was feeling better. Got me busy in the program in January. I wasn't sober 3 months yet. They made me secretary of the Fisher Park group. For the next 18 months, I was secretary of some group for 15 of those 18 months in Greensboro, making coffee, setting up chairs, putting out ashtrays, bringing cookies. We used to bring cookies back then because you could afford it. The crowd wasn't quite as big. Unlocking the joint, getting it locked up afterwards, cleaning up, getting the speakers. Most of the meetings were speaker meetings. Going around doing things, going to Durham, where I first met Brian, up over the East Durham Firehouse, and that long step up there where they've met up there, where I first met him, and not too long after that first day either. Those kinds of things. Love the fellowship. Love being with you people. Still do. Still do. Wade said to me a little later, he said, you hung around in this fellowship long enough, so that maybe you need to begin to work on a program that will sustain you in the event you're not exposed to the fellowship, don't have it available to you. And I knew what he was talking about, so we began to work on the step. And we didn't do it anywhere like I would suggest somebody do it today out of the book. I wouldn't give him a form to use. He gave me some other ideas, but it was firmly grounded in the program, and I began to work the step. And I began to develop a personal program of recovery outlined in the steps that would serve me well in the many 24 hours that have passed. A lot of things happened. I began to, I hadn't been in the program too long here, and I don't know anybody's been here too long. I hadn't been in too long, maybe a year and a half or so, and they were having trouble at Central Prison getting the all the AA groups to support the meeting over there on Sunday night called the Triangle Group. And so Tom, I, who some of you may have met, he's fairly visible, he asked some of us from Greensboro if we'd bring the program over there on the first and third Sunday night of every month. I did that for a year and a half with a group of guys, and it was very meaningful to me in my own recovery and in getting accustomed to a more a deeper giving away, something that was freely given to me. And I learned, because I'm an alcoholic. That was a step study group. And I can't go inside the walls of Central Prison or anywhere and lead a step study without studying up on it myself. Because I don't want... I'm like Bill. Bill didn't use the same words over and over again, mean the same thing in the book. He didn't want to look dumb. I didn't want to look dumb when I'm leading a step study. So I did those kind of things. And they were meaningful. Helpful in my growth. And went on in a little new pursuit in that area. We continued to grow as a family. My relationships in AA continued to develop. I continued to try to improve on this personal program of recovery that had been successful to me when I completed it the first time. I continued to try to improve on that. You know, meetings have always been important to me. I've already told you I love the fellowship, and I do. I love it. I love you people. Because of what this program has done for me, I've been able to be in many, many groups of people, fine people. But I'm never in a group of people where I feel the same as I do when I'm with you people. I feel the fellowship. I love being with you people. But I haven't kept going to a lot of meetings because of that. I've always kept going because there's always an opportunity there for me to hear something that's going to help me in improving my own personal program of recovery and permitting me to operate out there in a world which has some challenges and gain a measure of happiness, joyousness, and freedom. I remember Worth Williams. Worth Williams was talking at the Lawndale group one night, and he talked about filling up his shoebox of life. And I remember it. He talked about filling up his shoebox of life. And he said, you know, that in sobriety, he fills up his shoebox of life. He says, a lot of things go in that shoebox, but if I put in just nothing but Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the first thing he said he puts in there, and that's the first thing I put in the program, And the God of my understanding, which the program has permitted me to have a closer and closer relationship with after finding him again, it would be top-heavy. I had to put other things in there, he said. I had to put family in there. I had to put vocation in there. I may put in church. I may put in community. I may put in some other things to fill up the shoebox and keep it well-balanced. And I remembered that and remembered up until this morning about his filling up the shoebox. And after I heard that, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to fill up my shoebox of life. And a result of this program, I was permitted to do that and have been up through today to fill up my shoebox of life. And all of these things that were suggested in his own shoebox have gone into mine. And I've been able to keep it pretty well balanced. AA always goes in there first. It's been good to me. Folks, when I made that call to that minister and was introduced to those two men on that Sunday, I wanted one thing and one thing only: to get a handle to this drinking situation, which was killing me. And that's all. I didn't look for, nor did I expect anything else. And they didn't tell me early on that I could expect or achieve anything else. But I have. I have. You know, this program and you people and the God of my understanding, which I found here, and with whom I've been able to increase and cultivate a relationship with over the years, as a result of this program, have given me immense opportunities, immense gifts that I never knew I had, permitted me to use them. some achievements in certain areas which have been good to me and not gone to my head. It's been good. Quickly, in some of those areas, as you know, I left Greensboro in 1980, moved to Atlanta. Did that because I stumbled up the ladder. You know, I stumble up that daggum ladder when I wasn't drinking. I heard a fella say when I first came in the program that alcoholics are wired for additional voltage. I love it. I think we are. Boy, you clean us up and give us a job to do, we'll work circles around anybody else, do a 125% job. And I think probably I'm wired for additional voltage, so I would stumble up the ladder and vocationally, the vocation that I pursued because I have this program and a supporting God who loves me, gave me a chance to use the talents and skills that had been dormant and buried under the disease of alcoholism, permitted me to use them and use them successfully and well and to our advantage, and I hope to the advantage of the corporations that I worked for and with. Consequently, I was able to retire in August of 1992, and I'm glad of that. I was able to be a better family man. I had ceased a long time before you people got a hold of me to be a good husband, a good father, and I tried to be that again. Now, I've made some halting progress in some of those areas, but I'm better than I was, because family was important where I came from and the roots that I came out of, and I understood that important. I understood that important part of that shoebox. And I've done some other things that you people have permitted me to do to fill up my shoebox. If I wasn't here, how is it today? I want to tell you one other thing. You know, I get to a point, like all alcoholics in recovery, where you kind of hit a spot where you're coasting along, doing the same things. You know, there was an old term, rust out. I think maybe, you know, you got a little time in here, you know enough, you'll rust out. You know, well, in fact, I said that, told somebody at Matthew's group one night that I thought maybe I could go the rest of my life on the momentum. And they said, well, you got about as much momentum as anybody around here. But I reached a point like that, and I was introduced to some guys and at one point in my life, and a little later, the big wheel of this event this weekend sitting over there, Mr. Bivens asked me if I would consider getting involved in the Joe and Charlie type big book study format on a local basis, and he got me going on that in November 1989, and I've been able to do that some since then. I'm going to tell you, folks, it's very rewarding for me to do that. I'm awfully glad. I can tell you it's been a very, very important part of my own recovery and continued improvement in my recovery. Those kind of things that come along, when I've been coasting for a little while, something like that come along, and I'm going again, you see. And it's been that way. I still go to a lot of meetings. I go to a lot of meetings still because I enjoy the fellowship, but I still go because Polly will say something that turns me on, gets an idea going that I can use and it'll help me. Steve will say something. Larry will say something. Hank will say something. Somebody else, Chris will say something. Somebody will say something that helps me. I don't go there just for the fellowship. Still go to a lot of meetings. Tried to keep my shoebox filled up. Done a lot of things in community affairs, and I got back into church very quickly, and I've done a lot of things in church affairs, and they've all been rewarding. I don't dump church on anybody. I don't require the guys that I sponsor to go to church. Somebody says, why do you go there, and why is it so important to you? Quite honestly, I never got in any trouble there. And that's a pretty good endorsement, you know. I don't care. I never got in any trouble there, so I keep going back. If I wasn't standing here this morning, I'll tell you what I'd be doing. It's going to blow your mind. Now, I've been singing with church choirs and choral groups because I can sing a fairly mean second bass, okay? And I've enjoyed that. And I was singing the big choir, this big church in Matthews, and they were going to start a middle service, a contemporary service, and Barbara had said she'd like to go to that contemporary service. And I said, well, it ain't a sense of us going, both going to two different services. So they were having an audition for what they call a praise team. And I said, I guess I'll audition. I didn't audition for anything in my life. So I auditioned and made it. And that church meets at 9:40, and I'm on that praise team. Now, if you don't know what a praise team is, let me tell you what it is. It's a little singing group with guitars and drums and a synthesizer who sing contemporary Jonathan Christian music. And most of the singers are young. But not me. But I'm singing with that praise team in that contemporary church service. And I'm having a ball. I love it. I am really having a great time with this group of people. And there's no reason that I ought to be singing there. No logic for me to be with that group. And that's where I'd be if I wasn't standing up here. Right now, I'd be with that group. Amazing. All I wanted for you to do was to show me how to get over this drinking problem. And I'm doing something like that. Barbara and I have been married 42 and a half years. I'm retired. I do a lot of things. I stay busy all the time. The two girls that were next door couldn't be with me because I was unfit to be around. They're grown, raised, educated. Have married two men in whom I am well pleased. Have six grandchildren in whom I'm well pleased. I just love that kind of situation. I can play the role of grandfather and do the things that God expects of me to do in that role because of where this program has permitted me to come to from where I was that day. One of my granddaughters, I talked to her a little bit, that my friend Polly here is, I'll try to contain myself as I tell you about Abby. Abby is autistic, great little girl. I love her to death. I love all my grandchildren. Guess which one I love the most? I love Abby the most. Because Abby's sick, kind of like her grandfather. Couldn't do anything about it. Didn't have anything to do with why she's that way. But I'll tell you this, folks, she loves her grandpa. She knows every time I go over there that I'm going to bring a can of peanuts. She knows that when she climbs on me, I'll let her climb. She knows that when she wants me to put her head on the ceiling, I'm the only one tall enough in the family can do it, that I'm going to put her head on the ceiling. She calls it the roof. Put my head on the roof, Grandpa. I put her head on the roof. She couldn't have done that hadn't been for you people, program and a God of my understanding. I just came here to learn how to not drink, and that's been offered to me. I sometimes read things out of the newspaper that humor me, and I'll tell you a couple kind of quickly that humor me and what a message it has. One of them I read in the same newspaper one day, as Charlotte Disturber said. The first article in there was about Corinne Koenig, Sterling, and some of you South Carolina folks will remember her. And this article had to do with her 3.5 year jail term being reduced to 1 year. Judge let her out early on good behavior. In case you don't know who she is, she's the woman who, with I think suspended license for driving while intoxicated, was again driving while intoxicated, hit and killed Senator Strom Thurmond's daughter. And the reason that she was given reduced sentence for good behavior was that she had completed 2 5-week courses. One was in alcohol awareness. Now, how much more aware do you have to be? I don't understand that. See, how much more aware do you have to be of alcohol problems than to read your name on the headlines of the paper day in, day out for weeks from your own conduct? I don't understand that. But here's the other course that she took, anger and stress management. I want to get up on the judge's bench and say, Kareem, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll find out about alcoholism. You'll find out about the problem, the solution. And in a simple program of recovery, you'll learn all you need to know about anger and stress management. Great. Now, another article about John Wayne Bobbitt. You remember him? Same newspaper. John Wayne Bobbitt. You remember Bobbitt? Extremely fortunate and lucky fellow, I think. I would tell you, I think he is. I thought about that. If that had been me, you know, some stray dog would have come along and buried me. But this particular time, he was being sentenced because he beat up his girlfriend. You know, after everything else was back intact, he got this girlfriend and he beat her up. And here's what the judge sentenced him to. Two things. Attend impulse control meetings. I don't understand that. I don't know what an impulse control meeting is. But the other thing that he did tell him he needed to do was go to AA. Okay? But I want to get up there with the judge and say, John, let me tell you. You go to AA first. Switch these things around. You go to AA first. And you learn about your problem. And you learn about the solution. You learn about a simple program of action, which, if practiced, will control your impulses. Well, I'm telling you. Funny. Oh, dear. Bill says, you know, however, that there is a vast amount of fun about it all, he says. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity that we have here. But just underneath it, he says, there is deadly earnestness. Deadly earnestness. I'm still deadly earnest about this program of recovery that saved my life. In that article in the Grapevine in December 1987, it's summed up by saying that the only difference, he goes on to explain the miracle that passed on from Bill to Dr. Bob and continued its eternal journey into his life and continued its eternal journey into mine. And he said that miracle is the free gift of sobriety, freely given, mine for the taking. He says the only difference between those who recover and those who don't is that the people who recover and lead and come to Alcoholics Anonymous lead happy and productive lives. The difference between those and the ones that don't is that the willing pick up these tools, go to AA, and enjoy happy and productive lives, and the unwilling refuse to pick up these tools and fall by the wayside. That day I chose to pick up the tools. You people have laid other tools at my feet, also freely given. I've tried to pick up as many as I could and use as many as I could. You promised me that you'll keep laying these tools at my feet tomorrow and the next day, and I'll promise you that I'll try to pick up as many as I can and use as many as I can. Thank you, and God bless you.